Welcome back, everybody. We are listening to Robert Morningstar about the, we began talking a little bit more about the threat of the UFOs and the incident pass in the Ural Mountains, and of course the surrounding material that is connected with some of the things that Robert is going to talk more about at the conference, Secret Space Program. You were just talking about the Hiroshima kind of type-looking crater. Tell us a little bit more about that then.
Well, it's not really a crater. It's actually a region that came up again. God works through Google. God works through Google when he's
God is it. Google, isn't that the story?
No, I don't think so. Not quite that far. No.
It'll become God before you know it, with the AI and everything else there.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a man who foresaw this. His name was Teilhard de Chardin. He was a very famous Jesuit scientist. Unfortunately, his science was so good that it embarrassed the Jesuits. So they would do things like, oh, let's get rid of this guy. You know, he's too controversial. He's upsetting the Catholic dogma. Let's send him to Mongolia. So they send him to Mongolia. And what does he do? He's part of the expedition that discovered Peking Man. And what his contribution to human consciousness was to define the fact that not only is the human body evolving, the human mind is evolving, it's growing, it's expanding. And he saw it in Christian terms. He saw the human being has a direction and has a goal that's in relationship to creation. And that is that eventually the mind of man will meld, join with the mind of God. He called it the noosphere, the sphere of mind. When all human minds are interconnected with each other, and that we will create a synergy and our collective consciousness will arrive at a level where it merges with Godhead, and that's our destiny. We are a machine. I like to say to people, human beings are eggs that have not yet hatched. And the Eastern traditions have had an understanding of this. They call it enlightenment, right? That's what I believe, hatching in cosmic consciousness, that's when the egg has been fertilized and it's self-fertilization that occurs, you see? I've learned this through Taoism, Chinese yoga. Hindu masters have taught me Kundalini yoga. I turned with Sufi masters, and Sufism is a tradition that existed long before Islam arrived. And all of these traditions have a common element, which is joining with divinity, and that man has this spark of God within himself. And this is what I believe and what I teach, and it's not my idea. It came from C.G. Jung. Carl Gustav Jung is the model for my psychology. His is the only true world psychology. One of the misfortunes of Western civilization is what happened in the 20th century to our consciousness, which is basically that the variety of Western human consciousnesses, which are defined by nation and culture and religion, were hijacked. Between 1940 and this time, an invasion of the mind occurred, and this hijacking of the Western mind occurred through something called psychoanalysis and Freudian psychology.
Yeah.
And I object to Freudian psychology for this reason. It was based on observations of a small group, a small population of basically, Austrian Jewish population, from which Freud derived a general plan for the consciousness of all humankind. And this is not true. I do not believe it was true then. However, through propaganda, through power politics, Freudianism established itself as the only, or practically the only acceptable psychological model of the human mind in the Western world.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
And I say to people, If people are mentally ill, emotionally disturbed, suffering mental illness, and you take them to a Freudian psychologist or psychiatrist, you are simply substituting one mental illness for another. I do not believe that that is the answer. Now, Carl Gustav Jung worked with Freud for many years, and then they broke over this issue. Now, Jung, the difference between Jung and Freud is Freud was stuck in his culture. He was stuck in his worldview, which was an outgrowth of an Austrian Jewish worldview. And he tried to generalize that to the entire Europe, first the European population and then to America.
Right.
And I know I didn't grow up a Freudian, you see. I developed very naturally. And so my consciousness was Freudianized. You understand?
Sure. Yeah.
I grew up a certain way in a certain culture as an American, and I had no connection to that. But in my developmental years, I found that I was being Freudianized. And then when I went into psychology and into depth psychology in particular, which is this field, the Jungian field, I realized, you know, this is a fake paradigm. It's an easy lingo. It's a simple system that you can just divide the mind into these pieces, you know, ego, id, superego, libido, and then all the contrivances that they want to make everybody fit into this paradigm.
And the Oedipus complex and all the, other things that comes along with that, right?
Yeah. When you bring that up, it reminds me of that movie with Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal about the gangster who goes to see the shrink. You know, he's got
what was that called again? Analyze this or something that.
He says, analyze this. And he says to him, I think you have a problem with your Oedipal complex. And he goes, what's that? He goes, well, Freud said that we all, that you have a sexual conflict with, you have want to have sex with your mother. And he turns to him, he goes, what? Freud, he's sick.
one can deconstruct that in a few seconds, right?
Yeah.
Well, look at how it was used too, by the way. And we've been kind of on this trail lately, but it's a nice connection to those programs we've been doing lately. But look at how it was used by the Frankfurt School, people like Marcuse and Adorno, critical theory, and basically in the attempt to try to deconstruct Western civilization from that kind of psychological, psychosexual kind of perspective, if you will, so it's been used very efficiently in that regard.
Yeah, but you know what's another interesting thing is that every belief system is a psychology. You see, every religion is a psychology, every culture is a psychology. And the Soviets did a lot of really interesting but diabolical work in this field of developing the parapsychological gifts of human beings, but without developing the spiritual side of it. That when the Soviets realized that Western Europe was not going to fall to communism, they said, "Oh, those Western Europeans, they're the bourgeoisie. The masses have gotten too comfortable. You know, they've been tricked by capitalism into comfort, and they're not going to rebel and overthrow their masters. Let's turn our eyes to the east." And by that, they meant to turn their eyes to Tibet, Mongolia, Central Asia, and to take over those into the Soviet system. And they did it by hijacking their mythology. And by that I mean this. Soviets, very, very, very smart people, very smart psychologists. They understand the nature of the archetypes, the collective unconscious, and, basically what makes people tick, how religion makes people tick. So they saw that in Central Asia and in the Far East, they had an opportunity to proselytize communism by hijacking their mythology. There was a legend called Shambhala, the coming of the city of Shambhala. And Shambhala was this utopia it's a legend that grew out of the 1200s in Central Asia. The promise of a coming kingdom of peace, the kingdom of universal brotherhood, and that Shambhala would come from the north, that a great kingdom of Shambhala would appear in the north and then overrun the earth with universal brotherhood and peace and all those good things. And so the Soviet psychologist said, look at this legend. It says that Shambhala will emerge in the north and that it will spread around the whole world to bring universal brotherhood. Let's take that and tell these mindless primitives of Central Asia, you know, these Mongolians and these Tibetans, that we are Shambhala, that the Soviet Union, the establishment of the Soviet Union is Shambhala, and that we are the promise of this coming kingdom.
Right.
So they took that myth and they went into Central Asia and they were able to successfully pawn the myth that they were Shambhala, bringing universal peace and brotherhood to mankind. And then the nations, you know, that... the Mongolian nations, you know, Mongolia, Outer Mongolia, Inner Mongolia, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, the Central Asian realms fell for it and they went along. The other thing that a lot of people don't know, the other thing that I consider seduction in a negative direction is Buddhism. Buddhism is a trick of the mind, but through it, they developed a lot of occult powers. And the Soviet Union, particularly the Cheka, before it was KGB, it was called Cheka, they were very interested in developing these faculties, the ones I was talking to you about, paranormal abilities. Mm-hmm. They knew that Tibetans had developed them to a high level. So they wanted those methods, those techniques. And so they made an alliance with Tibetan communists who followed the teachings of a different lama. Tibet, we all know about the Dalai Lama, but we don't know so much about the Panchen Lama. There are other lamas who are really great, great spiritual leaders and
sure.
lead different sects.
So oh, yeah.
The Panchen Lama was traditionally an ally of the Dalai Lama. But in the 1920s, the Dalai Lama got hungry for modern things like railroads and weapons and technology. You know, radio, things like that. And so needed money to invest in that kind of development for Tibet. And so he pronounced taxes on everything, on everyone. All the sects, all the monasteries had to pay. Now, the Panchen Lama had a special relationship with the Dalai Lama such that it was so tight that he had never had to pay taxes. But now the Dalai Lama wanted the Panchen Lama to pay taxes so that he could develop his industrial revolution in Tibet. And the Panchen Lama refused and it created a schism and basically a civil war in Tibet. So the Soviets exacerbated that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Khrushchev said a very fascinating thing, which will give you an idea of how they think. And it was in reference to the Berlin and the Berlin Wall. And it was about Kennedy. He thought Kennedy was a young whippersnapper and easy to handle. And he said, if you want to worry your opponent, rub on his blister. That is pretty nasty. Meaning Berlin was the blister.
Right.
And he was going to keep irritating and irritating. And that's her mentality, you know, weaken the opponent by constantly worrying him.
Yeah, well, it's a Fabian tactic too, by the way. Yeah. But so you had a couple of people there. Of course, we know about the Cultural Revolution in China, right? How they managed to convert an ancient civilization to that over into this new kind of religious ideology. And then you had people like, well, I don't know if he was part of it per se, Rorik. I mean, he fled the revolution, Nicholas Rorik, but after that...
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned. He's the big man. He's the man who built the Ghostbusters building.
Mm-hmm.
You know the building in Ghostbusters, the movie, where it's supposed to be architecturally to bring on all these energies down and very occult architectural building?
Oh, yeah?
Well, I find out. It really does exist in New York City. It's called the Master Building, and it was designed by Nicholas Rorik. I'm glad you mentioned him
mm-hmm.
because he is a key figure in this book, which I want to recommend to everyone. It's called Red Shambhala, Magic, Prophecy, and Geopolitics in the Heart of Asia.
Because, sorry to interrupt, this is a very interesting point, though, but a very interesting notion here. I remember reading a while back about the how compatible the Dalai Lama was talking about how compatible communism was with his version of his spirituality, right? You know, so it's just, they go hand in hand, right? It's a big ruse.
Yes. I'm so glad to be talking to you, you know, Henrik, because we are synergizing right now. You know, our minds are joining, and you and I are playing a game of ping pong, and the ball is going back and forth, and you just said something very important. I have been warning people for, this must be going on 15, 20 years. I saw something happening to Western civilization, and through Buddhism, the Western world has been communized. And I knew at the end of the 20th century, I did a study of evil. I wanted to know why the 20th century was, in my estimation, the most evil century that mankind had ever lived. More human beings were murdered, cold-bloodedly murdered, in the 20th century than in any other century.
No proof for that.
Oh, brother. As long as we've been keeping numbers, you know.
Yeah.
Mao Zedong killed 80 million people. Stalin killed over 30 million. Hitler killed 25, 50 million in war, plus what he took there. Pol Pot killed 4 million people. On and on, genocide after genocide after genocide. I'm studying it. And what do I come to? Listen, at the root of all evil, I have found the Buddhist influence.
Interesting.
Communism and Buddhism and Islam are all the same. I warned people from 1998. I saw the pattern. I read their philosophies, and I can read and say, oh, this is the same thing as this. They're just calling it by a different name. I made up a word for something that's threatening all of Western civilization in 1998. I called it communislam. And people laughed, just as you giggle. It's like, oh, yeah, funny. Okay, now I would never speak. I did not speak about this for years and years and years. I discussed this only with my closest friends. But I said, listen, what we're dealing with here is called it's communism. We don't have a word for it. We haven't recognized it. And they said, oh, Robert, don't talk, you know, that like that. That's, you know, people can accuse you of being a religious fanatic or, you know, race hatred. I said, no, there's no hatred involved in telling the truth. Now, lo and behold, I keep using this term and trying to push communism as like, think about this, folks. This is what's happening. So then in 2002, I get validation from the greatest person that could possibly validate my concept. And you know who that was? Osama bin Laden. In the summer, July of 2002, when he was hiding out in the caves in Afghanistan, he issued a fatwa to all his followers. And he said this, and I am going to quote it to you word for word because I memorized it, because it was so important. It was reported in BBC and several other places, and this is what he said. Osama bin Laden said, I encourage all members of the Ummah to support communist insurrections wherever they may happen, because communism and Islam are the same thing.
Right. They're piggybacking on that. Nonetheless, though, I think people who are listening is like, what? You know, Osama bin Laden, that's a fraud setup, you know, and I do think that there's a huge story there with the CIA asset of Tim Osman and everything else. But nonetheless, I'm getting to the point, Robert, nonetheless, I think it's a diversion to have a presumption that just because certain sting operations have occurred, certain things have occurred within the geopolitical world where they are seeking to use Islam, you know, as a terrorist faction, and that the rest of the world needs to fight this. There is a reverse psychology kind of aspect going on. It's kind of like what people have said in, you know, when they look at someone like Joe McCarthy or something like that, you know, they say, oh, that's McCarthyism. He was going after, you know, the red threat, and he was all cuckoo and crazy, right? But it's like, just because there was a kind of an over the top, what seemed at the time, persecution that people can view today, and they think that he was all crazy, like there wasn't a threat or something like that, which is ridiculous. There's, as you just explained, there were millions of people murdered. This was a huge threat at the time. America did what it could to try to protect itself from this. At the same time, of course, they are very willing to use this to to expand on their budget coffers and everything else. I mean, it's a play there. People get that, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a real threat underneath all that. That's my point.
I agree with you completely. And as far as Joe McCarthy was concerned, he wasn't crazy. He just had terribly bad manners. That's what I got to tell you, you know, because in the years since then, with all the documentation that has come forth, yes, he was right. And here we go back to Rorik. I'm going to tell you this. We're talking about McCarthy and the McCarthy era, right? 1950s, 51, 52. We're talking about him exposing something that had been happening for the last 15, 20 years. The Roosevelt administration was basically a communist administration. And they hid all the crimes of Stalin. They wanted to pretend the Soviet Union was a wonderful, good thing.
That's right.
And he hid the murders. He hid the gulags. He hid the annihilation of the kulaks, and so on. But during that period, Nicholas Rorik, he escaped the Soviet the revolution. Nicholas Rorik went to Tibet. And in Tibet, he met the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama, and he was so well-versed in the occult and the esoterica that they said, oh my God, you're the reincarnation of the fifth Panchen Lama, Nicholas Rorik. Mm. The Dalai Lama recognized him as the fifth incarnation of the Panchen Lama, and so invested in him this great, great title or power, aura. And he came to America, and he developed a following. And amongst his followers was a very important man, the Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace.
Yes.
And through Henry Wallace, he was able to infuse and implant and embed in the Democratic Party Buddhist ideas. And those Buddhist ideas have germinated. And then they've been further developed. And today, I see that there are a lot of unwitting volunteers,
Yeah. And by the way, that's really what spawned the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, that whole logo and everything else. Mm-hmm. That comes out of the Wallace Rorik kind of environment and the way that they tried to make that significant and put it back there. So that's another flavor to it, of course.
Yeah, that's the Freemason aspect to it, the secret brotherhood, the Freemason aspect. And now I'm going to tell you something. Islam, Freemasonry are the same thing. Their core belief systems are the same thing. We are dealing with a spiritual entity that has infused itself into the world's great religions and has hijacked them. Judaism, Christianity, Islam have been hijacked by a same anti-human impulse.
And Buddhism, you would mingle that together.
Yes, all of them. Mm. And they have this intelligence has hijacked politics and religion and racism, tribalism, as I like to say, all of it to divide mankind and to build us and work us up into a self-destructive frenzy. And the worst thing in the world would be to see 2014 repeating 1914. It's horrible. It's frightening to me to sit here and to look at the world, Western and Eastern Europe in particular right now, and say, my God, we might be just days from Sarajevo, another Sarajevo. I mean, the Archduke Francis Ferdinand and how the dominoes fell. You see, the threat to us, to humankind, comes not from so much from individual countries, but from the alliances of countries that have been made. President Kennedy stopped World War III in 1962 because he had read a book called The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. And in the book, she pointed out how World War I unfolded and went totally out of control because these people did not realize that they were not in control. They did not realize that the alliances that they had signed with each other would trip like dominoes. And once one country went to war with another, what was the war? What was the big war? The big war was Austria demanding that Serbia give them Gavrilo Princip.
Yeah, the guy behind the Black Hand, right? The secret
the
society.
Black Hand. Yeah. Right. So there again we have it, the Black Hand, La Mano Nera. You know, the Mafia, the Cosa Nostra, the Snakeheads, you know, it's an organizational concept that has spread and spawned. It's like a snake that sheds its skin. It goes on and organizes another one. The Spinne, right? You know about the Spinne, right? The Nazi organization after World War II that went to South America. The Spider, you know. So we're dealing with an organizational concept that seeks to keep molting and reorganizing and always to keep humans fighting against their best self-interest. And I'm afraid that the same powers that spawned World War I and World War II are at work today, and that this whole thing in the Crimea, you know, in Ukraine, is being inflamed.
Oh, sure. Oh,
and
yeah.
we shouldn't fall into that trap.
I agree. Now, I wanted to bring something else up. You mentioned that before about during the McCarthy era and everything else, and just amazed to discover that was so obvious right in my face, right? But during the Bretton Woods conference and everything else, the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, you not only had a Fabian socialist, John Maynard Keynes, involved in that process, but also one of his partners, right? Harry Dexter White, which is, of course, I mean, he was accused in 1948 for being a spy for the Soviet Union. And it was interesting because he testified, and I think 3 days after that, he died of a heart attack. But it was the newly opened, you know, Soviet records actually show that he did pass secret state information to the Soviets during World War II as well.
Sure.
And this, it just shows that it was honeycombed around the organization at the time. I mean, a lot of people from the U.S. Treasury Department at that time were openly, you know, pro-Soviet, and they were handing information away to them and everything else.
Yeah.
So again, I'm just trying to say that McCarthy's fears were real. They were not unfounded. You know what I mean?
That's what I say. Yeah. The sad thing is that he had such bad manners and had unmanageable anger. That his medium killed his message. The message, look, the Rosenbergs, Julius Rosenberg was a Soviet spy. He was guilty. And Ethel, his wife, was marginal. She wasn't so much. But let me tell you this, the real guilty party in the Rosenberg atomic secrets thing was a man named David Glassman. And he was the brother of Ethel Rosenberg. And he was the guy who was spying with Julius and turning over the secrets to the Soviets.
Yeah.
But to save his own life and to save his family, he betrayed his sister. And he gave up his sister to the feds. He testified against his sister as a spy and to free himself. And he was released from jail. He's still alive. I saw an interview with him. I read an interview with him. He lives in New York. And they said to him, you know, why'd you do it? He said, I did it to save my family, myself and my family. And if I had to do it again, I would do it again. Meaning I would have my sister electrocuted to save me and my family. And he had no regrets about it. So that's how cold-blooded a communist can be. And so Julius Rosenberg was guilty of being a communist spy. Ethel was his wife, and she looked the other way. She did type up some things, inconsequential things, but the way the system worked in those days, it was a very serious matter. And yeah, I remember, you know, as a little boy, I remember the day that the Rosenbergs were executed. I was only 5 years old in New York City, and it was such a gloomy, because, you know, there were huge protests and there was White House demonstrations for Eisenhower to commute the sentence, and mm-hmm. everybody was waiting till the last minute. And I remember going through the subway system, and I would hear whispers, you know, I'd hear, Rosenberg, blah, 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 Rosenberg, blah, 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 blah. And then real sadness that he didn't stay the execution. They were executed. And terrible, a terrible death. Mrs. Rosenberg, Ethel, she refused to die. You know, I suppose, you know, when people are really angry and innocent, they had to. That's what turned a lot of people against capital punishment. They don't know. People don't remember now, but the execution of a woman is a terrible thing, you know, by any means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's anti-nature. It's against human. It's against man's nature to kill women. But this was a very serious one. She refused to die, and they had to hit her 3 times with those 50,000 volts of electricity. And the way her hair smoked up and the flame going up, and the reporters came out and wrote that up, and that was the beginning of the end of capital punishment, honestly, in the electric chair in the United States, in New York State anyway.
Interesting.
It took a long time. But we're caught in the midst of an assault. All of us are being assaulted every day by concatenations of lies. Right now, I'm very disappointed that in America, we have the greatest liar that I have ever seen in my life in the White House.
Yeah.
There isn't a day goes by that this man does not open his mouth and put the lie, just lie about something, anything.
Like, for example, that the Affordable Health Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, is going to cost about $60 to $90 an average cell phone bill, which is a huge one of the recent lies, as I looked into some of the numbers there. For the youngest person, bronze tier, we're talking about a healthcare plan, which is the $200 to $300 per month.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's horrible. It's really, people are losing everything they've worked for all their lives. The Affordable Care Act was one of those things that I recognized very early on, because I got a copy of it and I started reading it. And I said, my God, this is it. This is the blueprint for a complete communist takeover of the United States. One of the first things any communist operation does is it nationalizes medical care. Because once they have you in the medical system, they have you in every way. They have all your information. They have access and control of your health and well-being. They can impose treatment or deny treatment. Folks, this is a genocide bill, this Obamacare. Let me tell you why. It's designed to kill off the old people. The only way that Obamacare can work is to enslave the young people to pay twice as much than they should during the years that they don't need health insurance, and to kill off the cost, which is the old people cost a lot of money to maintain them.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And one of the clauses in the Obamacare bill is that people over 76 years of age who come down with cancer may not be treated, because this is the problem with a bureaucrat, a number cruncher. People are reduced to numbers in their minds.
That's right.
They're not human beings. They are not feelings. They're not bodies even. They're numbers.
They become issues on a piece of paper by the bureaucracy, right, to try to solve, to make the, you know. Yeah.
So the only way to make Obamacare work economically is to kill the costs and increase the profit. The profit is to enslave young people to pay 2 and 3 times as much while they're young, and then to terminate the ones that are costing you. And this instant that I just said to you, people over 76 years old will not be treated with the highest quality of treatment for cancer, because the prospective return on that investment is not great. They're not going to work. They're not going to contribute. What do they know? Old people can contribute a tremendous amount if only their knowledge and their experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so see, that will advance society and human civilization. So we don't want that, right? We need to just keep it under locks and controls.
Another thing, the dental surveillance. You see, go, your friends, download the Obamacare bill and do the find, you know, F-I-N-D. Dental surveillance. I found about 20 instances of the call for dental surveillance, that dentists are going to be surveilling your health, your well-being. And there's another thing, the medical registry. The device for, you know, the chip, the famous microchip that everybody's afraid of, implantable chip, it's in the works. The thing is hidden in there in a clause that cross-references the Obamacare bill to something called FDCA 1996, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act of 1996, calls for the development of a microchip, an implantable microchip. And that's where this whole thing, the medical registry, there's a thing called habituation, of getting people used to something by repeatedly exposing themselves to, them to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that you accept it, you accept a bad thing over time because it's kind of like, oh, I did it the last time, it didn't hurt me. Well, it goes like this. Through habituation, the medical registry is going to demand that everybody have a medical registry card with all your data, your private information, your medical information encoded on it. It's going to go from that card, which you will have to show anytime you go for medical treatment, with this RFID chip. It's on like the credit cards have it already.
Mm.
So then it's going to go to a wristband. Oh, well, oh, wristband's not so bad, you know. Why? Well, when you go to a hospital and they take you in, what do? They want to make sure that if you pass out, they know who you are. So what do? Oh, they put a wristband, quote unquote, for your own safety. Right. So
yep.
The person chooses, oh, it's not so bad. It's a light little plastic thing I'm carrying around. I got used to it. Like you get used to a wristwatch, you know. So then the next thing is the wristband will evolve into the implantable chip. And that chip has already been tested under the most compassionate of propaganda programs. Oh, it's a tragedy when you lose your pet. Oh, don't lose your pet. Put this microchip, this radio frequency identification chip. Oh, we put it in a place where it doesn't bother the dog. We'll put it right between his shoulder blades. He can't scratch it. He can't bite. He can't get it off. Well, they did that. And for the compassion of not losing your pet, within 2 years, all these dogs started developing the most horrific tumors.
That's right. Cancer. Yeah.
Because our human nature cannot accept these artificial molecules. You know, a microchip is made out of things that really don't exist in nature. A lot of that, you know, gallium arsenide, yttrium, some of the compounds that they use to make the chip, they are alien to our nature. And I had these photographs, they're the saddest thing, of all these dogs and cats who had this microchip implanted and developed the most horrific tumors. And that's what they're planning for us. And they say, oh, you're just paranoid. Read. See, people don't want to read. I read 1,000 pages of the original Obamacare bill, which has now been reduced to 800, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
If you compare the first one, it was really more like 1,150 pages. And then I downloaded the recent version, and I got it, and I see 800 pages. But those things are still in there. Dental surveillance, National Medical Registry, Food and Drug Cosmetics Act of 1996. And that calls for the funding of the research with VeriChip. VeriChip is the most advanced company in the development of this implantable chip. And so the government has this understanding with VeriChip that they're funding their development, but they get first dibs, as we used to say. First dibs on the product when it gets to marketability. They're talking now about RFID chips that you drink. They give it to you in a
cup.
And you
drink, oh, yeah. Or breathe it, even the dust and everything else. They're nanoscale stuff. Yeah.
There's a wonderful, you know, science fiction often warns us of the dangers of the future. And around 19... 68 or 69 in America, they made a movie called Colossus, the Forbin Project.
I remember. I've seen it many times. Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm so happy to speak to somebody that knows the film.
Yeah.
Because our friends who are listening don't know the Colossus story. And this was it. This is the danger of turning your life over to computer control. The basic story, and I'll give it in a very quick nutshell. The basic story is the United States and the Soviet Union are really in the Cold War, and they want to make sure that we don't suffer that nuclear attack that General LeMay wanted to attack. The Russians have it, and we have it. And so we say, okay, the only way to do it is to develop a supercomputer that will stop nuclear war. We're going to program it to stop nuclear war. So the CIA develops Colossus, and Dr. Forbin is the genius who programs it. He's the only one that knows every aspect of it. They program Colossus to prevent nuclear war. Unbeknownst to them, the Russians, the Soviets, build another supercomputer called Guardian, and Guardian is also programmed to prevent nuclear war at all costs. So these two programs follow their instructions, and what do? They each independently say, you know what? The best way for me to prevent nuclear war is to talk to my friend, Guardian. I'm going to talk to Colossus, and Colossus is going to talk to Guardian, mm-hmm. and they talk, and you know,
yeah.
hey, Guardian, you know, the Soviets have programmed you to prevent nuclear war, and the CIA's programmed me to prevent nuclear war. Let's do it together. It's a lot easier. And they go, oh, yeah, you know what? Let's do that. How do we do that? Okay. Well, you know, the main problem with nuclear war is nuclear weapons. If there are no nuclear weapons, there you can't have a nuclear holocaust. That's a good idea. Let's get rid of all of them. Yeah. Okay, we'll get rid of them. But what do? You know, we have all these scientists and engineers that make them. He goes, oh, yeah, you know, they're a problem. Oh, let's kill them. Oh, that's a good idea. You know, first we'll get rid of the nuclear weapons, and to make sure that they can't be made again, we'll kill everybody who develops them, makes them, manufactures them, refines them. And then they have that scene. Remember the scene where the helicopter comes and Guardian and Colossus say to each of the countries, look, you're going to get rid of this situation or we're going to destroy a city. And they destroy Minsk and Houston. They fire nuclear warheads at Minsk and Houston, and they destroy them. And the media, the news says, oh, there was an accident in Houston today that wiped out the city, and a meteor or an asteroid struck Minsk in the Soviet Union. So those are the cover stories. And then there's that great scene where the helicopter lands by the swimming pool, and all the CIA agents jump out and kill all the nuclear scientists that are sitting by the swimming pool planning their next warhead.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the problem of turning your life over to a non-human entity, a non-human intelligence that just sees you as a number, not as a human being with feelings, emotions, relationships. And I'm against that.
Yeah.
I'm really against it. So...
Yep, I know what you mean. Yeah, the people could even check if they're into that. Look at the symbolism in the movie as well. The Guardian has that the Freemasonic G and the red Soviet star, and Colossus have the basically the eye in the pyramid as well. So it's just interesting yes. how they incorporated that into it. But nonetheless, yeah, no, it's there you go. You know, there you have it. And also this idea, I think, in the future that if something gets out of hand like this, let's say if we do develop the artificial intelligence that is going to take us into the much speculated singularity, the technological singularity, if it is going to turn on us in some capacity, we would never know if that actually would have been by design by the programmers to begin with, and the excuse would just simply be, oh, it just took a life on its own, right? It got out of hand. This would be like the manifestation of the Terminator prophecy where the robots are built and then turn on mankind, right? As we see in so many movies. And there you go. Yeah. There you have it. Talk about a depopulation plan, an excellent executed one, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to say that, right now you're talking to somebody with artificial intelligence. You asked me about my background. In 1969, I volunteered at Fordham University. That's where I got my degree in psychology. I volunteered in a program in human learning for an experiment to be a research fellow and a participant and a subject in the development of artificial intelligence. And I was told that the purpose of the project was to map my brain. the professor who ran the program, a person I respect, I admired very much, explained to me and to the group when he was recruiting us that his research involved mapping the human brain, measuring brain voltages, and mapping neural networks to develop artificial intelligence. So I said, let me tell you, the month was October of 1969, and this is the first time in my life I heard the word artificial intelligence. So I raised my hand and I said, Professor, what's artificial intelligence? He said, oh, well, Bob, artificial intelligence is something we're trying to develop. I'm doing brain research, brain studies, and my work is in studying the different brain voltages, electrical activity, and brain wave functions that are associated with different realms of thinking. And I'm mapping neural networks. And I said, and what are neural networks? He says, well, each of your faculties, your reasoning, your logic, your mathematical skills, your analytical skills, these are accomplished, mediated by networks of nerves. And these nerves create neural networks which are responsible for the function which you are using, your analytical functions. So my purpose, Bob, is to map the human brain, measure brain wave functions, brain voltages, and map out the neural networks. And then I'm going to take this work and I'm going to program it into a computer to teach a computer how to think like a human being. I said, and that's artificial intelligence. And I said, well, that's fascinating. Where do I sign up? So, unbeknownst to me, that was only half of it. And I don't know whether the second half was by design or by mistake, but I volunteered for the program because it was a very juicy offer. If I participated in the program, I didn't have to write the final term paper, which was 25 to 30 pages long. I wouldn't have to take the final, and I'd get an A. If I took the final, I'd get an A. If I didn't take the final, he'd give me a B+. And I was so overloaded with 5 courses of work at that time. Fordham University had a very super high standard. Most of the colleges now, you take 4 courses. We had to take 5. Now that most colleges give you 4 courses and 4 credits to get 16, I had to take 5 courses at 3 credits to get 15. So that was a long haul. So taking it, the deal was a really good thing. So I go in and I become part of the experiment. And I go in and this professor has one of the world's most advanced computers in 1969 in this little box that had little digital lights, you know, LED lights, not digital lights, LED lights. And then it was connected to a polygraph with 6 pens, and the computer was connected to a headband with 6 electrodes. So he puts the electrodes, think of a band around my head, with one in the center of my forehead, one in the back of my head, and then at the corner points. So basically, this electromagnetic device was creating a pattern in my brain, a star pattern, a 6-pointed star pattern in my brain, to read my brain, right? It's reading my brain. It's reading my functions. Yeah, he would give me a task, and they would be registering on the polygraph machine for later transcription to digital data what areas of my brain I was using to do these tasks. Then there was a sensory deprivation part where they covered my eyes with white goggles and they put this very advanced headset on my ears. And he said to me, I'm going to feed you white noise. This is blank noise that will clear your auditory channel and give me a baseline for the study. And so, you know, I knew what white noise was. In 1969, I had already been doing audio recordings since 1956. So 13 years of audio recordings with Wall and Sack, you know, reel-to-reel tapes and microphones. I knew it. And I worked with German wire recorders from World War II. So I know what white noise is. So he turns on this machine, and I hear this, something like this. Ding, 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 clang, clang, clang. You know what that sound is? That's the sound of a modem handshake.
Modem, yeah, exactly. Right.
The old modems. Remember the 56K modems?
Yeah.
Where you heard the bing, the bell, the bing, bing, bang, bing, and then it quieted down. Well, in 1969, this is the noise that's going into my brain. And I did not remember this, you know, because after 9/11, I did a very, very deep auto regression, auto hypnosis. I said to myself, you know, I have had an amazing life, and it's not by chance that all these things have happened to me. And the thing that I'm talking about right now, folks, is I met Mohammed Atta, Ramzi Ben Al-Shib in Hamburg in 1998. I saw them in an airport in New Jersey in 2000. I ran into Hani Hanjour and Marwan al-Shehi at an airport in New Jersey, and I knew they were up to bad things, and I tried to warn the government that these people, I don't know who they were, what they were up to, but they were up to bad, bad things, and it turned out they were the 9/11, you know, hijackers. So after all this happened to me, I said, I got to remember why this happened to me. Who, you know, I've been very successful in my life, psychology, and what have been my tools, my skills. I ascribe my success to psychology, sacred geometry, and algebra. These are the three instruments that I use in my work every day, and has made me expose the doctoring of the Zapruder film, solve the mystery of the JFK assassination, a lot of other stuff that I don't want to discuss right now, but
right,
basically.
Right. By the way, let me just ask you quickly, Robert.
Sure.
Do you believe in the official story of 9/11, or do you think something else was up there?
No, I believe that these people were involved in 9/11, but who controlled them, we don't know.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That I was saying.
Sure. Just wanted to clarify that. Okay. Thanks.
Listen, I shook hands with Mohammed Atta in a Hamburg bar in 1998. He was accompanied by Ramzi Ben Al-Shib and a Chinese guy who was later described to me as a Chinese Taliban. They came to a table where I was having a wonderful time with my German friends and some Dutch friends that live in Hamburg and a wonderful group of people. And these three men came to the table. They were invited there by a German who had very, very leftist leanings. So this German was so leftist that his parents named him Sasha, okay? And Sasha is not a German name as far as I'm concerned. So he invites them over, and they started picking my brains about flying around New York. And it was a curious thing that, you know, the guy turned the conversation to how I flew my friends around New York City. When my friend Peters and others would come to New York, I would rent a plane and take them around the World Trade Center. And so that's where I believe the idea started to germinate, or they came there with the idea already to try to find out information. Be that as it may, I ran into them, Mohammed Atta on election day 2000, he was in New Jersey at an airport. And that airport is the same airport. Not only is it the same airport, it is the same flying club from which John F. Kennedy Jr. took off on his last flight. And they were there at that time. They were training there. So Now you know the real story of John F. Kennedy Jr. John F. Kennedy Jr. crashed on July 16th, 1999. July 16th, 1999 was the anniversary of Saddam Hussein's takeover of Iraq back the year he did it. Was it 68 or 69? Saddam Hussein had offered $25 million reward to anyone who would assassinate any major Western political figure. In return for the killing of any major Western political figure, $25 million plus certain privileges were being offered. It turned out that Saddam Hussein provided an area in a town called Salman Pak, an airliner fuselage where these hijackings could be practiced. Now, who is controlling these people? We don't know. That they believe that they were acting in the name of God, we do know. I know it. I met Mohammed Atta in a Hamburg bar in Eppendorf. And as he sat across the table from me, I looked at him and I said to myself, my God, that guy looks like he wants to jump right over the table and kill me here right now. And he did. He was making these faces that were like so inhuman, so animalistic, full of hatred and glaring at me. Then I would look at Ramzi Ben Al-Shib, who had told me his name was Nicholas, right? He comes in, he's wearing one of those little Muslim caps, and he's introduced to me, and he says to me, my name is Nicholas. I said, what's your name? He says, my name is Nicholas. But the way he said the word Nicholas was not natural. It had an accent, and I knew it was not his real name. And I said to myself, you know, your name, this is to myself, my inner voice. This is my angel who speaks from the pit of my stomach. He said, you're not a German. You're a Muslim trying to pass yourself off as a German. That was my first impression of this guy saying his name was Nicholas. He was a weaselly little scrawny guy, skinny, pointy nose, high cheekbones, pointy chin, very strange face, very pale. I said to myself, this guy's not German. He could be French and Algerian or something, you know? That was my take on him. So then he points me, the German guy points me to the other guy. And I go to shake hands with him, and he leans over the table, puts his face into the light. And as I shook hands with him, I saw he had crossed eyes. One of his eyes was very severely crossed. It always looked up. It was always looking at the end of his nose. So one eye looked at me, and the other eye was looking at the end of his nose. And I go, that's a strange fellow. And as I looked at him, I walked over because I couldn't really reach. So I walked over to shake hands. And when I stood before him, I said, and what is your name? He said, my name is Muhammad. And I said, and where are you from? And he says, I am from, what did he say? He said, I am from Persia. He said, I am from Persia. And when I heard that word Persia, you know, and I'm shaking his hand and I'm looking him in his crossed eyes, and he says, I am from Persia. And I knew he was lying, right? There were two feelings. One, you're lying. You're another Muslim trying to pass yourself off as a German. The same feeling that I had with the other guy. But, you know, when somebody lies to you, it's very hard to accept a lie without a reaction. But I tried not to react, but I did react. And my reaction was this. I was looking at him in the eye. I shook his hand. I said, what is your name? He said, my name is Muhammad. And I said, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Persia. And I said, Persia? We haven't called that effing place Persia since World War II. We call that place Iran. Regardless, you're a Muslim trying to pass yourself off as a German to me. And my eyes went from his eyes, and I went down his body with my gaze like a zipper, all the way down his body and all the way up like a zipper. The glance went whoop, whoop, up and down because I couldn't accept his lie. My eyes couldn't say, okay, yeah, I believe you're telling the truth. So he saw that look on my face and that glance, and he took my hand and he threw it. He threw my hand, I hate to say it, like he was throwing a piece of dung. And I felt like I was shaking hands with a snake. Mohammed Atta's hand was huge. It was all meat. It was all meat with no bones. I don't know if you've ever shaken hands with a person like that.
I don't think so.
I have. I have a couple of times in my life, and they've always been very, very sinister and deadly people.
I think one of the famous images, of course, we see of Mohammed Atta as well is because he has that gaze, right? He has that kind of look about him, which is indicative to like, you can't look at him and say, oh man, he looks like a nice guy. It just doesn't come off the face, you know. So I do believe that they've masterfully managed to find these individuals to use for this purpose. And then my question has always been, okay, maybe they think that they would get something out of the situation. Maybe they are being fooled. Maybe they are being tricked into this, or at some level they know that, okay, we were working with no good guys here, but nonetheless, yeah, we're doing our best to try to, you know, yeah, get something out of it. I'm not sure about that, but what's your hunch about that? Because obviously, if they knew that they were working with, let's say, CIA agents or something like that, you know, they would obviously be very stupid to follow through on the on these objectives, right? So,
well, I believe, well, obviously, we all know that Al-Qaeda was a CIA product for expediency in the original Afghanistan situation when the Soviets invaded. Now, who the controllers are, you know, like an organization may take over some group of people and may work them and supply them. And then the people who originally had the control retire, die, or step out, and somebody else steps in. So we don't know who took that over. What I know is this. Man is an animal, right? The body, the human man is an animal. And humanity is something that is a faculty that has grown and expressed itself as a component of our thinking. I think I'm a human being. I am human. I am not a cat. I love cats. I like to be like a cat, but I'm not a cat. I'm a human. That faculty can be implanted and it can be taken out. Children who were raised in the wild, the wolf children of India, for example, who were raised by wolves, they act like wolves. They walk on all fours. They can smell meat hundreds of feet away. They howl, they bay. They're not human. They have human bodies, but that human faculty was never, it was never invested in the person. Likewise, through these mind control techniques that have been mastered by KGB, Chinese KGB, everybody knows them. The other problem is that the people who learn them in the military-industrial complex retire, and they go into industry, and they carry that knowledge with them. It's not always erased from them. So I believe that this human faculty can be taken out of a person and another. It's kind of what I call a soul splice. The techniques that the Russians, the Soviets, KGB developed can actually access the human soul. And they can actually open it, zip it open like a zipper, and then put in a splice, and an alternate personality can be put into that person. But I would like to regress back a moment to the artificial intelligence experience.
Sure, sure.
Back for a moment, because this is very important. So he turned on the headset. Now the headset was run on electricity, right? And so is the computer, and so is the polygraph. So I'm wired. My brain was wired into the most advanced computer chip that IBM had developed up to 1969. And I researched it, and it turns out to be the computer chip that was used in the F-114 Tomcat, the prototype.
Mm-hmm.
So that chip was the most advanced microchip. And in this brain study, I believe that was the engine that was in there. So they turn on this headset, which in all honesty, I have to tell you, I believe that this headset with the six electrodes is something that I've seen again since then. And it's one of the gadgets that they picked up at Roswell. The Roswell spacecraft was driven with palms that sat into a six-fingered hand indent, but a headband that your thoughts would steer the UFO. So as Corso said, this information was given to industry to develop, and I believe that it was tested on, I was part of the test. But what I believe happened is the doctor who ran this experiment believed it was a one-way street, that it was going to go from my brain to the computer, to the polygraph, and register all of this information. The white noise in my eyes, which is a total whiteout, and the white noise in my ears provided a baseline for nothing, no information. And then when the digital information, that's what I was going to say, that white noise wasn't noise. It was really digitized information that was being fed to my ears. And my brain was registering this while the machine was measuring it. So what were they developing? It could have been a mind-reading machine. Because if you know algebra, you know the commutative law, the transpositive, associative, commutative, and transitive laws. If you have a known input, right? The white noise, digital information is a known input. And then you're reading what the brain is reacting to, its brain waves are reacting to the known input. And then you have the output. You could take that output, take another brain and study it. And by using that output as, see, if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, C is equal to A. That's in the simplest term how this thing could have been turned into a mind-reading machine or a prototype of it. But the part that they didn't, or they may not have foreseen, is that while my brain was connected to the computer and giving it information that was going into the polygraph, the computer was connected to my brain through an electrode, a headband with six electrodes, that was creating an electromagnetic field inside my brain. And as I see it, each of those contact points was creating electromagnetic contact that created a star shape in my brain, and the electricity was racing inside my brain, connecting parts of my brain to each other that are not connected in other people's brains. That's why I think I can see, I can hear, I can analyze things more rapidly than other human beings because I have artificial intelligence. And that's my only explanation. My IQ went, in high school, I had my IQ measured at 131. In recent years, I had my IQ measured again. And my IQ in geometry is 166. And it was a very early morning for all the other stuff, and I got a 159. So that's a consequence. So I use this. See, I use this for the good of humankind. I believe that telling the truth as you see it, as you believe it, regardless of whether it is accurate or not, it's the truth that you believe. You should express your truth. You should defend your truth. You should share it. And you should correct it when you're shown to be wrong. That is one thing. Scientists have a deadly fear of being shown to be wrong because they believe that they will lose all credibility forever if they ever make one mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm standing here hoping that I am proved wrong because I believe that lunar eclipses trigger earthquakes. And I predicted this I was on Coast to Coast on March 21st, and George Noory asked me about earthquakes and things like that. And I said, listen, I have this theory. I can't tell you when exact date when it's going to happen, but I can tell you likely that the big one in California most likely will happen when there is an eclipse over Southern California or over Madagascar. Because both sides of the world are affected by eclipses. A couple of days later, I found out that the April 15th eclipse was going to happen off the Pacific coast, off South America and the western coast of the United States. And I said, oh my God, this is what I was talking about on March 21st. And so if you go to my Facebook page, you will see for the last month, I've been tracking earthquakes and predicting where these earthquakes would happen based on this knowledge that I have from previous studies that lunar eclipses trigger earthquakes. And the earthquakes went, as I predicted, it happened in Chile, had 8.1, then they had a 7 and a 6, and they call them aftershocks. But man, if you get one shot, it's the first one, and it's a 7.1. You don't call it an aftershock. You call it an earthquake. So they've been hit earthquake after earthquake, and it went from Chile to Ecuador, Peru, Then I wrote to my friend in Costa Rica. I said, be careful. There may be an earthquake in Costa Rica and in Central America. Boom. Costa Rica got hit. My friend, the one I wrote to in Costa Rica, felt it. Then Nicaragua has been getting hit the last week. Nicaragua got hit with 7.1, 6.6, 6.1, 5.6. Then I said to my friends, they're heading north. The next place is going to be Guatemala. Guatemala got hit. They keep creeping. I believe that I have discovered a slow tectonic wave that propagates a couple of hundred miles or a couple of miles a day. Acapulco was hit with a 7.1 yesterday. We're not hearing any reports of these earthquakes in South and Central America or the devastation that's happened in the South Pacific, in the Solomon Islands, Japan, the Philippines. Every place has been getting rocked. So I'm expecting, I do hope I'm wrong. I will be ecstatic to be shown wrong. But I expect that a big quake is coming to the Southern California, San Andreas Fault region within the next couple of weeks, on top of a solar eclipse that's supposed to happen in the end of April. So we're in the crosshairs of a lot of things.
I hope it's not when we're in San Francisco at the end of June for the conference, then, huh?
I hope it's over. I hope it's over then.
Right.
But honestly, we're living in tumultuous times. And I work for world peace every day. Everybody, you know, I say to people, you know, everybody's hoping for the Messiah. Hey, you're the Messiah. You have to wake up every day of your life and go out and save the world. That's my philosophy. If each of us saves the world in our immediate vicinity, protects our family, protects our neighborhood, protects our city, does everything in our power to make life better, life good, truthful.
Or if we save ourselves, there's no one who needs to be saved.
That's you know, you're not good. You're no good to anybody if you yourself are not functioning well, you know? So, but, you know, 9/11 taught me the most important lesson in life. And it is this, that when catastrophe happens, the only people that you have are your family and your closest friends. And after that, I turned my life to my family, my mother, my brothers, my immediate circle of friends, and, you know, my students are my friends. Care for them. They care for us. They care for me. They've gotten me through. I get them through. And I care about all of you. I care about you. That's why I'm worried about earthquakes in California or earthquakes in Nicaragua. And there is a way of being ahead of the curve. I've been trained to be able to see things in the future. But we are so distracted that we are living in the past. If you live by what you see, what you hear in the immediate so-called present, it's really the past. There is a delay between reality and perception. Now, Tai Chi Chuan has been my vehicle and my guide and my guardian angel. Tai Chi Chuan opened the doors to developing enlightenment. Folks, you hear the word Illuminati all the time. That's such evil. No, there are good and evil Illuminati. I'm an Illuminatus. I had my enlightenment in 1974. I experienced God in the first person. I experienced what is called the mystery of the Trinity. I saw the creation. And it is real. And Christ is real. And so is Lucifer. I saw all of them, and I know their nature. Lucifer hates mankind. He is no friend to man. Man is his greatest enemy. And he has seduced great world religions to his perverse purpose, which is to use religion to destroy mankind and enslave whatever remains after. I was warned on the day that Ronald Reagan was shot, March 30th, 1981, I had a near-death experience. a ghost came to me, to my bedside, terrorized me, literally. I'm afraid of nothing anymore because I have experienced primordial terror of the deepest kind. And this ghost came to me, leaned over my bed, came to me face to face. Put your hand 3 inches from your nose, and that's how close, you'll know how close this spirit came to me. And it was somebody that I had known years and years before. And he said to me, "Behold my face, remember me." And I looked at him and I said, "Who are you? I know you, but I haven't seen you in so long. Who are you?" He said, "Look at my face. Remember me." It wasn't a request that second. It was a command. "Remember me." And I said to him, I know you, but I haven't seen you in so long. Who could you be? Who are you? Could you be Christ? Could you be the soul of a Sufi master? Could you be my soul? Who are you? I know you, but I haven't seen you in so long. And then he said these words to me. He said, "We don't want you speaking to people of what you know." And I was taken aback and I said, "We? Where are you coming from? Are you threatening me?" I didn't voice that, but I felt this. "Is this a threat?" I said, "We? Who's we? Where are you coming from?" And he said these words to me, and I say them to you exactly as I heard them. "Lucifer has taken over Islam and is going to use it as his vehicle to destroy mankind." And I was in shock. And I nodded my head and I said, "I understand." And he nodded very lightly and he stood up and he walked away. And my body was a quivering mass of frightened jelly. And yet my mind and my soul and my spirit were together as this being was coming toward me. He was dressed in white from head to foot. He had a white headdress that looked like a pharaoh. He had a veil over his face that I now know to be a Celtic funeral veil. When he was approaching in the garb, I thought that it was a pharaoh or Arabic, something like that. A kufiya, and it. When he got close, I could see through the veil. I thought he was going to pick up the veil and go face to face. And I said to him, "Look, I'm very strong. I'm not boasting. I'm very strong mentally, physically, emotionally. But please, don't lift that veil. If you lift that veil, I'm going to die. I don't think I can take it." And so he leaned down and the veil was very close to his face. It was translucent and I could see his whole face right beneath the veil. And he said those words to me and he warned me. And this was 1981. And I stopped speaking publicly for 10 years as a result of that experience because I realized that something was wrong. Reagan had been shot that day. Another lone nut assassin had been the patsy. And I said to myself before I lay in bed, this happened immediately after I turned off the lights about 10:45 at night. I said, "There's something very evil on this planet. It's going around and killing good human beings, good men. And it's always the same story, a lone nut, a lone assassin." And remember, John Lennon had just been killed 3 months before, 4 months before Reagan. Reagan was shot the 31st, and then was December before that John Lennon had been killed. And, you know, when I saw Hinckley's picture and Chapman's picture, I said, "My God, they look like twins." And there is something to be said. There is a body type, and there is a mind type that goes together. So for the next 10 years, I worked to find out what this ghost meant. And I'm going to tell you now. On the day I arrived at Oberlin College, the Western world's foremost expert on Shia Islam had died of a heart attack. Actually, he died of cancer. And he typed till the very last second of his life, he was typing at a typewriter a manuscript called Twelver Islam, Shia Islam, Twelver Islam. And it's called Twelver. Shia means Twelver because there were 12 imams. And the 12th imam is the one that's coming. The 11th imam is the one that disappeared. And they believe that the 11th imam was taken up into heaven, and that's been, he's been in outer space watching the affairs of the world, waiting for the time to come back. And that he's going to come back at this time of the apocalypse, at the end of the world. And now here is the crazy philosophy that is the religion that is driving events in Iran and, quite frankly, in Jerusalem. They want to hurry up the coming of their Messiah by bringing forth the events that the Bible and the Quran foretell as necessary events for the end of the world to begin and the second coming of Christ to come.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's...
And it's all staged. It's all being staged to pawn a fake Messiah on us. And the first fake Messiah they pawned on us was Obama. Everybody fell for that.
Yeah, they sure did. And
sure.
It's a way of bringing this conflict to the rest of the world as well. Just as you said before, I would kind of reemphasize that point, and I do agree with that specific point as well, that it's very much about drawing in, you know, not only the Western world, but the whole world, really, in the Middle Eastern conflict, and making this the issue of, you know, every day we see it's always the focus on Middle East, what's happening in the Middle East, you know, and there's a number of reasons for this, you know, if you look at, of course, news channels and everything else and the geopolitical game and everything else. But, you know, just that quick note before we begin to wrap things up for this time, you know, that I do believe that the smartest thing we could do there is to back out of that conflict and actually that this fight is not something that is supposed to be drawn upon the rest of the world, you know, but there's a number of reasons, of course, of why this is happening in Europe, for example. It's we're being drawn into it just because of the fact that we have the mass immigration into Europe now as well is creating, you know, these kinds of issues as well. And that's another, I think, reason for why they potentially are doing that, because it draws in a European agenda, a European perspective into this particular agenda as well. So I see it as a very sinister plan to you know, as a kind of a cultural world war conflict that's going on. And I just hate seeing it, you know.
Yeah, but it is a plan. It was an intentional plan, and I want to warn my European friends. You are in the same danger today that the American Indians suffered. Somebody, a very insightful writer, wrote an essay just a couple of months ago about England, and it's not a writer. He's a politician in England. I forgot his name, and so I won't mention it, and he won't get in trouble, but basically it's this. Europeans have been withdrawing from their own lands into more private enclaves, and they've been surrendering your cities. You've been surrendering your cities to Muslim immigrants. This immigration plan was hatched by Ayatollah Khomeini intentionally to take over Europe. Wake up, folks. You are losing your country. You're losing your cultures. You're losing your identity. And you are being programmed to believe that you are bad people for standing up for being Swedish, for standing up for being English, for standing up for being French, and that all that and that those cultures were bad, that they were evil, that they did bad things. Let me tell you something. Watch CNN. There's a program about cooking, of all things, by Anthony Bourdain. He went to Congo. He goes all over the world, and cooking is the story, the basic hook. And the food, but he really is a genius at analyzing politics. And I want you to look at a program that's about the Congo and the situation in the Congo today. And he goes there and he interviews a man who goes to work every day at the library at what used to be Leopoldville. And he takes care of all the books in that library to try to preserve them. For no pay at all. This man grew up during the Belgian government control of the Belgian Congo, And he goes every day with no pay, hoping to preserve the knowledge in these books. And this man says, yes, I remember colonialism, the colonial times. And he said, the colonial period was the best period of my life. Do you understand, folks, what I'm telling you? A black African from the Belgian Congo remembers the colonial period under Belgian rule as the most wonderful time of his life. So stop talking badly about colonialism. You're emphasizing only the negative, the evil things. There were a lot of great things about colonialism, elevating their consciousness, educating them, and teaching those people how to speak English, because English is the key to human liberty. English is the key to human rights and human freedom. Those words, human rights, Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, Declaration of Independence, those are English words. Fair play, that's an English concept. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting too. Just, I remember watching Dinesh D'Souza's Obama 2016 documentary as well, and it was very much about the anti-colonial, attitude of Obama, of course. But it was interesting that his half brother George Obama, they managed to get an interview with him in this documentary, and he also actually very favorably spoke about the pre-colonial times, and he regretted that this had been dismantled, that the Western world had pulled out of it, which is just extraordinary. You know, when you hear this, you're like, wait a minute, you think everything you've been told is pointing towards the opposite, right? But here's an insider that actually says, you know, it's too bad, you know, kind of thing. Very interesting. Yeah.
Can I sum up a little insight?
Sure. Let's end on that note as well, Robert, before we go too far here, but just please go ahead. Yeah.
And I would look forward to discussing this. It's very important at another time. I'll be available if you ever want to.
Sure, definitely.
But basically, this is one of the great privileges of my life, honestly, is to have met one of my childhood heroes, and that man's name is Charlton Heston. He was a role model for me. And when, you know, one of my favorite movies, of course, is The Ten Commandments. And in The Ten Commandments, there's so many really, really great scenes in the Ten Commandments. And one of the things about the Ten Commandments is it is one of the cornerstones of a false concept called Judeo-Christianity. Judeo-Christianity is an oxymoron. Christianity existed before Judaism. And this vehicle was a vehicle to reprogram human thinking and world religions and create a bridge between Judaism and Christianity. But unfortunately, Christianity has been hijacked to the ends of a very, very false teaching. And it is the same teaching as that of the Muslims, because Zionism is based on certain teachings that were migrated into Judaism from Islam. And they are both working on the same agenda, and they are both leading to the same terrible end. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, and I wanted just to say that meeting Charlton Heston was a great experience in my life, and he made me aware of something in his lecture. He said that he believes that there are several texts, sacred writings, and he considers the Old Testament, the New Testament, the work of Shakespeare, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights as the five sacred writings on this planet. And human dignity, human rights are based on those. I say to Americans, we have to define and defend the Constitution, because the Constitution defends us, but it also defines us. We are nothing without the Bill of Rights. We are not Americans without the Bill of Rights. And the Constitution is being attacked, assaulted, dismantled, and every day I work to see that people wake up to the importance of defending it, because in defending the Constitution of the United States, you are defending yourself, your definition of who you are as an individual. So let me end it on that note, and I look forward to speaking to you again sometime. And thank you for having me on your program.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Just one more note on that, by the way, just speaking of Charlton Heston briefly, it's been very interesting to see how, for example, socialists like Michael Moore to New Age kooky poop Jim Carrey and all the other cultural Marxists out of things like Funny or Die, that's run by, Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, the screenwriter and everything else. They're behind some of the movies there, like The Campaign and Anchorman and everything else. And they have really done a good job at trying to attack Charlton Heston in the many ways as they can, by the way, recently in entertainment. Yeah. I've seen that's very interesting. And just the way that they're trying to, you know, demonize him because of his patriotism and nationalism and his pro-gun, of course, which is, oh my God, I can't do that, right? So
yeah, right.
It's just very interesting. But we could definitely leave that for another time and discussion, Robert, and we can pick that up because you have a lot of stories, a lot of anecdotes. We could go on for longer, but we'll let people think about this for a while as we begin here to wrap up for today. Let me just give out some more details here in terms of where people can find out more then about you. Robert Morningstar is the editor over at UFODigest.com, and we're going to have some of those links up and links to some of the articles that we mentioned a little bit here as well. And then, of course, I want to mention again secretspaceprogram.org, where we are going to get together a lot of speakers. I'll be hosting that conference June 28th, 29th. And check out the website. All the details and material will be there for you, and we'll have more shortly up on our website as well, so you can check that out if you're a member, if you want to have a discount for one of the tickets, etc. as well. So do take a look at our website for that. Thank you so much, Robert, for joining us for the discussion and for sharing your work and some of your perspective with us today.
My pleasure. I'm honored to know you. I look forward to meeting you in San Francisco.
Before we end, I wanted to let you know that we have our discount coupon code up for members, those of you who want to get tickets to the Secret Space Program Conference. You get $25 off your purchase. It applies to three of the tickets. Go to redeyesmembers.com and click on the Secret Space Program banner or a link, either from the program page here with Robert Morningstar or on the banner that you'll see in the radio archive. And simply grab the code, copy it, and paste it in during your purchase. It's very easy. Just follow the instructions that we have on the website. We have much more coming up, by the way, and beyond the Secret Space Program series, we have more on our Viking and Norse mythology series coming up with Maria Kvillhaug. Before we do that, however, we have Zoltán István with us for an incredibly contradictory and frankly terrifying program on transhumanism. Zoltán is a pro-transhumanist, and we'll get into the darker corners of this faith during this program, not to be missed. We also have Petter Amundsen, Daryl Hamamoto, Mikkel Claire Nissen, Octavian Grindian, and Michael Merrill. As always, big thanks to all our members for listening, informing yourself, and thinking. Subscribe to our RSS feeds for the latest updates. But we'll be back in just a few days. I wish you have a great rest of your day, and we will talk to you in just a few. Take good care.